Members, we're going to get started. It's a couple of minutes past our starting time. I apologize. Today's conversation is going to be focused on school-based mental health. Obviously, this is an issue that's been on top of many policymakers and parents and citizens across the nation ever since the the tragic, horrible incidents out in Connecticut, about a month ago, I believe it is. And I think that it's important for us to have a conversation early in the session about the state, if you will, of our mental health counseling presence in our K-12 schools, understanding the connection not only to the well-being of students, but also to the ability to address mental health issues as they impact our desired outcomes, academic K-12 outcomes. And members, one of the things that I'm struck with is I've not really delved or specialized at all in this area. Some of you, I think Representative Barrett, I think you've got some background in this area. Some of you know that there is actually a complex web of relationships that are necessary for us to have a very mature system of addressing the needs of our students, including the needs of the mental health needs of our students. And so my hope today is to be able for us to walk away with a deeper understanding of what the key elements of those systems are and how key players within that system relate to one another, and what our role has been in terms of providing a strong policy frame that allows them to do that, as well as ultimately a strong resource frame that allows them to do that. And so I've asked representative of stakeholder groups to come and share their insights, and I ask that they speak about their experiences also in terms of how they relate with one another within that system. And members, we are privileged to have my good friend and our former colleague, Tom Tilbury, with us today. Tom served on this committee with many of us several years ago. We did a lot of good work together. My understanding is Tom's got to get back to the classroom relatively quickly, so I know he's number 7 on the list, but I'm going to exercise a little privilege here and call out our former colleague to come forward first and begin our testimony. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Representative Mariani. And it is a pleasure to be back and talk in front of this committee. It's a different role for me for the last 6 years or so, but I'm really looking forward to signing this clipboard. I never got a chance to sign this clipboard that you were a testifier, so that's going to be kind of fun.
Although, Representative Tilbury, I do remember several bill hearings with you sitting right in that chair and me over here, so feels good to see you again.
Well, and I guess what I'm coming here to speak on behalf of the Minnesota School Counselors Association. And the reason that I'm here is to also mention that when we're thinking of different tragedies and so on that happen, there is a place at our school level that includes all of the different professions. And if you recall, and some of you may be new, may not have known this, but back in 2007, we had put together some legislation that was for the maintenance of effort for student support personnel. It didn't say counselors versus social workers or counselors versus psychologists. It brought everybody to the table and said each spot has their necessary roles within schools. Now, given that, that maintenance of effort, however, was repealed in 2010, and a lot of the times it was because of local control issues or some of that, where school districts wanted to say, for local control purposes, we are having trouble funding this or whatever. The intent behind the legislation was to increase counselors in schools, but it also would increase wherever the need would have been. If someone district needed a psychologist, that would have taken place, or a social worker, whatever the need that the school district would have. And unfortunately, that never really came to fruition to see any advancements on our ratios for all of our professions. With that in mind, the only thing that I come to the table with is another area of funding. And the piece for funding that does hit Minnesota school counselors is that they're really tied to the general fund. They do not have really access to the special ed dollars, or if there is a way to have special ed dollars to get for counselors, either the districts don't do that or don't know to do that, or however it works in that direction. So how that came about, where psychologists, social workers were pretty much tuned into getting money reimbursed from the special ed dollars, that would be something that has never really happened for counselors. And then also, I'd like to kind of go on the record for Minnesota School Counselors Association. We have never come to the table in my time here and also before that ever pitting one group against another to try to obtain dollars. That was never our intent. So if ever we talk about ratios where we're 48th or 49th in the nation for counselors, the whole idea behind that is not to grab money from another existing group in order to fund counselors. The idea is to mention that we're all needed at that table for our specific professions. Our students need that. One of the things that happens whenever, like in Governor Dayton's budget, where he may be talking about mental health dollars and where that all gets allocated or how that's being looked at, whether that happens on the outside, outside of the school or whatever, those dollars that are coming in maybe through collaborative dollars or other situations where maybe mental health professionals would be assisting schools in their need, that's what it is. It's they're vital also. I'm going to give you an example of how this could work, and then I'll leave the committee with your thoughts. It happened on Monday, because today's Thursday. Yeah, it happened on Monday. Over the weekend, a student was writing kind of an assignment to an English teacher. The assignment was supposed to be something of self-reflection and so on. The starting paragraph started out with, "I really am not going to do the assignment today. I'm really going to talk about how I feel." And how this particular student then went into about a two-page paper about how they may be committing suicide later on, either in the day or maybe in the week. But in the first paragraph was directed to the teacher, "Don't tell my parents. Don't pass this information on to the parents." So immediately, well, obviously, counselor in the building Monday morning gets this email message from the weekend, comes in to really pursue this particular case, found out also that the letter or email was forwarded to the parents anyway from the teacher to inform them of something going on, and the parents said they had a discussion, wrote an email back. So when the counselor walked in the morning of, the parent had an email back to that particular teacher saying, "I talked with my son or daughter, let's say, and this is what took place. We're okay, no problems." So then immediately Monday morning, bring in the student and start talking to the student and working with that student, only to find out that later on that day there was a plan in place. Everything was going to go like clockwork, that this student was going to end his life at the end of the day. What would have happened if there wasn't a professional in that building? If you follow the transition of that, let's say that that student ended up in the emergency room, which is like a high traumatic place to be for a student in that situation, but the school members put that student through getting them out of the building, notifying the parents, and getting them to where they need to be. So now we talk about follow-up care. Who does follow-up care? In this particular situation, possibly an outside mental health professional would have the ability and the time to take that it is necessary to help this student get back to transition part. So I think that that's the way that can interrelate with that. But I go back to, if this particular counselor was not available on Monday morning, you know, where would we go with this student? This student was going to commit suicide. And the thing that never gets put down really in tangible statistics is, how many suicides did you prevent this week? How do you write that down? because I'd really like to know, because I think a lot of you around the table would love to have this kind of thing too. But the reason that it come forth is to just let you know that the Minnesota School Counselors, you know, I'm representing them today in their quest to be able to help our children. So then when tragedies do take place, you know, we are ready for that. Sometimes I think that schools have been put in a terrible spot of having to fund different professions and have shortchanged some of those in order to keep the schools going and class sizes possibly, you know, up into the 40s or beyond. I mean, it's been quite the challenge to be able to fund appropriate levels to all schools. And we're talking about rural schools also. But I think that if we understand that everyone has a need to be at that table, to do their profession, to help our students, that is where we really truly need to be. And I am so glad that you're able to give me some time with that today. And I know the struggles that it will be to answer questions or answer the questions of the budgets and so on. I'm hoping that there isn't going to be this winners and losers type mentality. That's the part that I struggled with when I was here, where if you were voiceful enough, you had enough lobby support, you had enough parent support or whatever, then you were the winner this time. And the next time around, maybe you didn't fare so well. It just depended on the politics of the day. But our kids' lives are depending on this. It cannot go as politics of the day. So that's why I come in today. And I'm opening myself up for any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Wise words from a great colleague. It's early in session, but I already miss you, Representative Tilbury. And wonderful framing, I think, of the discussion then that will come before us that will allow us to, I believe, have a good insight into the different components of a strong system, but to keep us focused on the fact that on the proposition that it takes a system to best serve our students. Representative Tilbury, I'm not going to subject you to the question and answer. We need to get you in the classroom in about 15 minutes. Plus, I also want to ask Sue Abderholden to come forward, who I've asked to structure the rest of the hearing today, so she'll also provide an important context. But thank you for the work that you do on behalf of our students, and look forward to continuing our relationship with you.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. It's a pleasure to see you again.
Very well. Sue Abderholden, if you can come forward. And while Sue comes forward, I'm wondering, Representative Crescia, would you be so kind as to move the minutes of the January 29th hearing? Minutes are in your packets.
Thank you. I will do that.
Thank you. Motion to adopt the minutes. Discussion. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Minutes are adopted. Thank you, members. Sue Abderholden, thank you, Sue, for coming. And I apologize in front of everyone for throwing you that curveball with my good friend Tom. I only learned this morning that he needed to get out of here awfully quick, and so I didn't have time to circle around to you. But I think he helped also to set the context so that we want to be able to set here. But please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sue Abderholden, NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning. About 20% of children between the ages of 9 and 17 have a diagnosable mental illness or substance use disorder, but only 20% will actually receive treatment. Left untreated, it impacts their ability to do well in school, at home, and in the community. Without treatment, they are likely to face multiple suspensions, do poorly in school, drop out, end up in the juvenile justice system, become homeless, or frankly die by suicide. National survey data for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention notes that approximately 14% of high school students seriously consider suicide each year, 11% have a suicide plan, and 6% attempt suicide. Roughly half of all adults who live with a serious mental illness began experiencing symptoms before the age of 14, so we know that if we are to provide early intervention and supports, we can't wait until they're adults. Families face multiple barriers in accessing mental health treatment for their child. Insurance may not cover their mental health treatment. Mental health parity doesn't require coverage. It just says if you cover it, you have to do it in the same way. They may face high deductibles or may not have insurance at all. Others face barriers related to transportation, not being able to take off work, mistrust of the system, or long waiting lists to get in. School-linked mental health services were included in the 2007 Mental Health Initiative, which was a bipartisan effort by a Republican governor and a Democratic legislature to really address some of the key problems we were seeing in both our children and adult mental health system. These are grants through the Department of Human Services, so they are not education grants, and they're provided to actually mental health providers who then collaborate with the school to provide clinical mental health services such as diagnostic assessments, individual family therapy, group therapy, skills training, medication management, etc. The providers bill both private and public insurance for the treatment, and then the grants are used to pay for treatment for children who are uninsured or underinsured, and for the collaborative work with teachers and other ancillary work such as meeting with parents, care coordination, psychiatric consultation, etc., that is not billable to insurance. Another benefit of Minnesota's model is that FERPA, our federal privacy around education records, trumps HIPAA, our healthcare records data privacy act, meaning that because these are not school personnel providing treatment, the child's mental health care records are covered by healthcare privacy laws and are not part of the child's school records. From July 2008 until December 2011, we have served a little over 13 children. Over half have never received services before, and half of those children had a serious mental illness. The referrals are made from a variety of people, including teachers, student services, the family, crisis staff, county staff, and even primary care. General education teachers were most likely to refer a child who had never received services before. We currently have 20 grantees serving roughly 65 counties, 200 districts, and 500 schools. We are at this time, however, in only about 17% of the schools. I'm going to now turn it over to Mark Sander to talk about the outcomes. Let me just point out, you have some handouts, but you also have the positive behavior intervention support little triangle that if you don't know about it, by the end of the session, you will know more than you ever wanted to. But you can see it's kind of a gradation in terms of the needs of kids. And the very top of the triangle there, the tertiary level, those are the children that have kind of the more serious mental illnesses that need treatment. And the school-linked mental health grants are really focused more on them and maybe a little bit of this middle one. But what many of the PBIS programs around the state will say is, if we don't have any way to really help those kids at the top of the triangle, we're not really doing our job. And so the school-linked mental health grants then are a really good model to fit with them. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any quick questions from Ms. Adler-Holden? Representative Leidinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question on the statistics. The 9 through 17-year-olds, 20%, et cetera, et cetera. Where did we get that data? I mean, is that collected? Was that a school study, or was that our Health and Human Services study, please?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leidinger, it's actually from the National Institute of Mental Health. They do prevalence data surveys, and that's where we get it. And it's stayed pretty constant over the last decade at least.
Thank you.
And I don't want to put words in your mouth, Ms. Representative Leidinger, but I suspect that part of the question came from your testimony earlier about certain data not being, falling under a different data set of rules and regulations, and therefore perhaps not being as transparent. Certainly not as transparent for school officials. So maybe is there a relationship between that and Representative Leidinger's question?
Mr. Chairman, no, actually. Okay. I mean, we can count the number of children who actually receive treatment, but many families don't want those mental health care records to be part of a child's school records. In a kind of slang way to say it, they don't want other people seeing their business about their child. And so, they want those records kept in the healthcare system and not the education system.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for the clarification. Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is about the map of the school-linked mental health grants. I see a lot of counties that weren't involved in that. Were those based on need? And if so, how was need determined?
Ms. Abderholden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Faust, this was a grant process, so there was a request for proposal. Community mental health centers would apply. There was clearly not enough money at all to be able to grant money to everyone who applied. And then there might have been some situations where they didn't apply because they weren't able to get the collaboration necessary from the school district to be part of the application.
Thank you. And Ms. Abderholden, I know that these accounts are not within this stream and certainly not within Representative Marquardt's finance stream, but what is the state generally of what's been the trend, I suppose, is the question over the past few years relative to the MDH grants that make this kind of model work and this kind of intervention possible? Have we been appropriating more or less? What's the status?
Mr. Chairman, we've been able to keep the funding safe, I guess, protected, but it has not gone up since it was first passed in 2007, so it's about $4.77 million. In the governor's budget, he does include a 50% increase for the first year of the biennium and 100% increase the second year. We actually don't think we can go much beyond that because we don't have enough mental health professionals to hire to be able to really serve all the schools.
Yeah.
Former Representative Tilbury, you talked about, you know, some of the local collaborative dollars and things like that that sometimes counties will use to help fund this thing. We've seen those dollars decrease, so we've really focused on these state dollars that go specifically for school-linked mental health.
Thank you. Members, thank you for the quick questions. Representative Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Hold on. I'm sorry. After Representative Benson's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is not a question particularly to the present presented here, but a brief commentary on former Representative Tilbury's presentation. Very brief. I just would like my colleagues to know that I will be introducing a bill having to do with counselors. I've shown it already to the chair. The issue has to do with the difficulty we have. Not only with counselors, but school psychologists, school nurses, and other auxiliary support staff, because of a shortage of funding, school districts are forced to make these choices. I'm going to introduce the bill as a way, a vehicle for us to look at this issue seriously. As you know, I also have bills on reducing school mandates, unfunded school mandates, so I'm faced with a kind of a conundrum here at the same time, but this is such an important issue that I think it deserves time in this committee and the other. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I look forward to seeing the bill and having the hearing. I'm going to violate my own rule because our lead minority member has a question, and I want to make sure that we're deferring appropriately. So Representative Erickson.
Oh, thank you, Chair Mariani. That was very gracious of you. To what extent, Ms. Abernathy, does your group work with the medical profession?
Ms. Abernathy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erickson, our group, well, NAMI, you know, works very closely with the Hospital Association, the Medical Association, the nurses, with, you know, everyone that we can, because everyone kind of comes into contact with children or adults who live with a mental illness, partly because we don't have enough mental health professionals. Mm-hmm. We have very few psychiatrists in the state, and so our pediatricians and our family practitioners are actually doing a lot of the diagnosing and treating because we don't have enough other people, which is actually why it's kind of nice to have the school linked. Because you can actually see someone who, a therapist who can spend, you know, mental health professional who can spend some more time on that diagnostic assessment than perhaps a family practitioner can, and who can actually collaborate with that family practitioner. I will say we need this whole spectrum. Mental health is a spectrum, and we need all of the different professionals, whether it's school counselors or a psychiatrist. We need all of them to really help children succeed in their life.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden, and I think Chair Mariani, as we discuss this, I think it's important that we keep the medical profession engaged because they have the expertise that we may need as we develop a plan.
I concur, Representative Erickson. So let's proceed. So we're going to hear from the different components, if you will, of our system. Mr. Sander from Minneapolis Hennepin County School Link Mental Health Services. Good morning, Mrs. Sander.
Good morning. Chair, representatives, thank you very much. I'm Dr. Mark Sander. I'm a clinical psychologist with Hennepin County. For the last 8 years, I've been in a joint appointment between Hennepin County and the Minneapolis Public Schools. In that role, I helped start the school mental health program with colleagues in Minneapolis. And in the beginning, we started in 5 schools in 2005. Currently, we are in 25 schools in Minneapolis. And across Hennepin County, we're in about 80 schools. And all of those are through partnerships between mental health agencies and schools. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. But school mental health is something that I'm very passionate about, and I'm very honored to be here to be able to talk to you about it today. As Sue talked about, there's an urgent need to get children and adolescents connected to the right level of care as quickly as we can. And by having school-linked mental health services, we can get quick and convenient access to high-quality clinical mental health services and supports. But as others have already mentioned today, we also have a cadre of professionals already working in schools that can help support the social-emotional development of students. And again, to really get to that full continuum for kids who don't have clinical diagnoses, who need support and some direction, and don't need that clinical diagnosis and treatment. So SchoolLink Mental Health really does bring that clinical treatment component to a place that's really easy for families and students to access. So in Minneapolis, how it works is that we've got 4 mental health agencies that we partner with. Washburn Center for Children, Guadalupe Alternative Programs, Watercourse Counseling, and the City of Minneapolis Health Department. And with those agencies, they provide a full-time mental health professional at each of the 25 schools. So there's a full-time licensed mental health professional there at each of the 25 schools to provide treatment with parental consent to students at the schools. And what we've seen from our data from the past 8 years, and it's been pretty consistent, is access is significantly increased. 85% of the students who are identified or seen at least once face-to-face. Out in the outpatient community, it's more about like 40 to 50% are seen. They're seen quickly. 70% are seen within 10 days or less. And what we found is that 50% or more of them have never received mental health services before. And that's really significant. These are kids who really need have clinical mental health needs, who had never gotten treatment for whatever reason. What we've also found is that we're able to keep them engaged successfully in care, meaning that we're average of 17 clinical visits in a school year, and that's important because treatment takes time. When I was in graduate school, brief therapy was 10 sessions. I mean, it's not just a quick visit to your pediatrician. We need to build relationships, support, have interventions, and really help the student use those interventions. So on to some of the data that you've got in this packet here, and I'll move through it quickly because I want to give time to my alert.
In your packets?
So as Sue had mentioned, the SchoolLink Mental Health Grants in the past 3.5 years have seen over 13,000 unduplicated students. Half of them were found to have never had mental health services before, and half of them were found to have serious emotional mental health issues. And that's actually a designation meaning that they could be at risk for out-of-home placement in the next year. So these were not the worried well. These were kids who really had significant concerns. What we've also found is that both parents and teachers report decreases in mental health symptoms, and that's been pretty consistent, and that's using the Strength of Difficulties questionnaire. We also have data showing that decrease in school suspension, an increase in attendance. We also have principals and school social workers reporting through survey data decreases in office referrals and suspensions. And as you see on some of your charts here, again, these are just some graphics of some of the things that I've already mentioned about first-time access to treatment, Your next page here is some DHS data on improvement of symptoms. And then this last page is data on suspensions. And what I'd also point out is that the bottom chart also looks at African-American students in particular, and we found that there was still we still had reductions in suspensions after 1 year of treatment, and they actually closed the gap with the regular the full treatment group at the bottom there. So for me, what this all kind of points to, and excuse me, one important point that I left out is that SchoolLink Mental Health is specifically designed to work with and build upon the work already being done by school psychologists, school counselors, school social workers, and school nurses. We don't want to duplicate the work. There's plenty of work to go around. And so what and so it really is that partnering together and the collaboration, and that's, like Sue said, where this SchoolLink grant money is so important, is for the collaboration dollars to consult with teachers to integrate treatment into the classroom and the lunchroom and out on recess to have those students be able to work there, and then also to collaborate with the school hired professional staff to really support students. In closing, I just want to say that I feel that SchoolLink Mental Health has had proven results. We've got the data, and we've got a lot more data to kind of show this. I think we know how to make school mental health work in Minnesota and how to be successful. And I think we just need the will and the energy and the funding to really move this forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Sander. Just a very quick question, and don't take my question as a reflection that I'm not caring about other aspects of a student's life. I mean, I understand that really ultimately what we're talking about here is the whole person. Perspective, and hopefully we'll hear more about what that means. But my understanding is that our ability to the extent that we've been able to provide the kind of easy, full-spectrum, interactions with students in need, that one of the results of that is, and obviously you shared suspension rates issues, but one of the results of that has been increase in academic academic achievement. Can you say a little bit about that and how, whether or not we track that? And I mean, obviously, you know, there's sort of a logical connection here. If young people are in school as opposed to being suspended, that there's a correlation there with the ability to achieve. But perhaps if we can just say a little bit more about that.
Absolutely, Chair. I appreciate the question. You're absolutely right. I think, you know, what we've known for a long time is that untreated mental illness is a barrier to learning. We are doing research, and we have found some positive trends related to students' academic achievement, especially related to reading scores. I think... if I put my researcher hat on, we need more data. The study was only of 113 treatment students and only 113 comparison students, but the results were very promising and really showed that students did kind of increase their level of academic achievement. And I think what it speaks to is when we remove those barriers to learning, then teachers, high-quality teachers, their instruction can really have a greater impact on students. And like you said, having students in the classroom, not being suspended, not being absent, again, that's what schools want. They know how to do rigorous instruction. We just need to have the kids there and to have the kids ready to learn.
Thank you, Dr. Sander. We have a couple questions. I'm going to circle back to you, Representative Sawatsky. There you are. I'm used to looking for you over here. You had a question earlier, but perhaps...
that and a comment. Mr. Chair, I'm a middle school teacher in Wilmer and been involved with the SchoolLink program with Woodland Centers, and I just want to say that when that is no longer in existence, it's there's a void and a hole, and somebody else has to pick up the slack, and you're very much correct that they do. It's first of all, it's nice because if they're meeting with somebody for 20 minutes, they're not taking a drive someplace else for half a day, or because you're sitting and waiting some, you know, to see a doctor, therapist, whatever. So when they're there, it's a can be a quick type of treatment in session. So those are all important things. And you're right, it's a whole school system that works with our students with their mental health. So it is, and it's taxing now on the rest of us when we don't have the facility coming to us, and but we do have good communication. And as also, teachers are forgiving when we know that there's other things going on in their lives, and not forgiving that we're letting them off the hook, but we work with that individual, so, or those kids that need that extra different kind of direction.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, Representative Sawatzky, since you're from Wilmer, whether there are, from your perspective, perhaps Dr. Sander, if you're aware, please chime in. But you know, whether there are some distinctions, geographic distinctions in our state in terms of access to full spectrum care, collaborative, systemic approaches. I suppose I can ask more and more questions about, the state of, where our students are at. Are there differences? But I'm curious more than anything else. I don't live in Greater Minnesota, so I'm not aware of those dynamics. Do you feel that there's any sort of unique challenges in any of those areas in regards to?
You know, kids are kids. No. It doesn't matter if you're country or rural or city or. They're human beings, and we all. It's high poverty. We'll get into stories.
Okay. All right. So, Sander, yeah.
Sure, Chair, representatives. What I would just say is that I think when I go to the school-linked grantee, the grantees have about three meetings a year, and so I get to meet with a lot of the grantees from Greater Minnesota. And what we do hear about is the long travel times. Representative mentioned that when kids have to go and see a provider, that provider could be an hour away. Yeah. And so I think that's geographically that's one of the issues. So being able to bring the services to where the students are is something that I think we've heard from Greater Minnesota as such a huge service and such a difference maker for them. And I think the other thing that the School Link grants can do is also being able to help teachers better understand how to work with students with mental health issues and how to kind of support them and hold them accountable, but also be empathetic and compassionate with them.
Thank you. We'll take one more question, and we'll go on to our next testifier, Representative Leidinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, I want to try to bring it down to the deck plates level. How do the children access the mental health services? If you think that you try to deal with most problems at the very lowest level, do counselors then give referrals to the mental health representative?
Mm-hmm.
Did the teachers do that?
Mm-hmm.
Is it an open door policy where a child can just kind of sign up and get in there on his own? So if you just run through that quickly, mm-hmm. and I just have a comment that you said it a couple of times. Only 50% of the students that come in have never seen a representative before. In my view, that sounds pretty low. I would think it'd be more like 90%. I mean, because it's really, in most cases, that's the first time a child may have some sort of exposure to that kind of mental health facility. In a lot of cases, when they're troubled as they go through school, it's an outlet for them. So would you just address the access?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative, what I would say about how the referrals are made, and kind of, I want to start with when you talked about the open door policy and some of those things. That is where our student support staff are so critical. They can do the open door policy. They can have the student who was suicidal and the teacher finds out and they let the school counselor know, they can go and have access to them immediately. With the community providers in the building, we need to get parent permission to be able to talk with that student. And so, and parental consent, just like out in the outpatient. So that's why we really need all of us in the buildings. And so, again, and you talked about wanting to see them as early as possible. Absolutely. I think, you know, teachers and kind of any, in Minneapolis, what we do is anybody in the schools can see a concern, have a concern about a student, but typically there's a point person or maybe a point team that they bring it to. And that typically in Minneapolis is the school social workers or the student support team, and they'll talk about it. What is Tommy or Susie getting already? Are they seeing somebody outside? Because they're all going to know that. And if they go, you know what, this is really a student who might benefit from the School Link mental health services at our school, they'll reach out to the parent and say, hey, we've noticed that Susie's been a lot more withdrawn lately. She seems sad. Have you noticed that? And the parent says, yeah, we have. And they say, well, you know, there's these community-based resources, but we've got this resource at our school. Would you like them to give you a call? Mom says, yes, I would be interested in that. And then they're able to get that clinician, the community provider, connected with that family. And then the family comes in, and now it's the relationship, like Sue talked about, between that community agency and that family, just like it is at their outpatient clinic, but now the clinic's at the school. And so we protect those records, but the communication, the collaboration is different. Verbally, we talk about what we're doing. It's just protecting that record, because that record can kind of go places and we don't know where it goes. Mm-hmm. And we worry about that because we want to protect children and families' rights to privacy.
Representative Leiter.
Just a quick follow-up. That is encouraging. I mean, you're bringing the families in, so you're getting all the players in the room. Who pays for that then? When does the insurance...
Absolutely.
Family insurance, get involved there.
Chair. Dr. Sander, quickly.
Mm-hmm. Really quickly, what I'll say is that we, in Minneapolis, and I think in Hennepin County, and I think in a lot of the other grants, about 70%, 60 to 70% of the cost is covered by third-party reimbursement. So because these are clinical mental health services, that, you know, and the treatment, all of the interventions would qualify for third-party reimbursement through healthcare or Medicaid or other public insurance programs. We go, you know, we really try and collect all of those appropriate dollars as we can. But if the family does not have insurance, they're still able to access care, and that's where these grants come in. Sometimes counties will pay for the uninsured. In Hennepin County, they have contracts with a lot of the providers to cover the uninsured. So that's where, but these grant programs are really important because that consultation and coordination isn't currently covered by health plans.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Great question. That helped me to understand a little bit more the importance of the consultation and the collaborative and how we support, you know, those efforts. I'm going to move us forward, members. I take it you must be Pahua
Yang.
Pahua Yang from Wilder Wilder School Linked Mental Health Services. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Pahua Yang, as I just said, and I come from the Wilder Foundation, a nonprofit health and human services organization. I'm a clinical social worker, and I also have a doctorate in educational psychology, so I get the privilege of often bridging lots of worlds for my colleagues. At the Wilder Foundation, I work as a mental health clinician, and I also supervise the mental health therapy team as well as the children's mental health case managers. My testimony today is informed by these experiences. Wilder specializes in culturally specific mental health services for children and adults in the East Metro. And specifically, our work with African American children and Asian American children is partially supported by a school-linked mental health grant. Our school-based services are built on the cultural strengths of students and their families, and we take a whole child perspective when working with our families. We know that we can help children and their families create change that goes beyond symptoms and behaviors. We think and we've seen that we can help them create change that is long-lasting for their lives. This grant has really supported the holistic success of the kids that we work with in our community, and is a wonderful example of our collaboration with the St. Paul Schools, which really has been a crucial part of the success of many of the children that we've served. I'm going to bring the statistics down to an example that I'd like to share with all of you to really illustrate why this type of program is so important to ensuring access and success for the children that are in our communities. I'd like to share with you today the story of one of our girls, Kay. She is a Hmong American student who joined one of the groups that we run at her high school, and the group is run by one of my staff, a Hmong mental health professional. And she was actually referred to the group because she was coming to school one day a week, and she had a 0.5 GPA. Now, my staff and I were trying to figure out what that meant because we didn't know that that was possible. Mm-hmm. And that's a D minus, by the way.
Okay.
What we learned about her was she was an extremely depressed young woman who had refused to engage in treatment anywhere else. In fact, she had been continually referred to various mental health clinics throughout the Twin Cities, and she had failed every single one of those appointments. This is actually a pretty common experience for many of the families that we serve, because we know that access to mental health services and to mental health treatment is so much more than having an appointment. It's really, for many of the families that we work with, it's really about the acceptability of that service. So how people feel and think about that service. Do they buy into it? Do they think it's going to be helpful? Does it fit with what they think is going to be healing? This young woman has a pretty extensive, so as we got to know her, we got to know that she had a pretty extensive history of sexual abuse, relationship violence, and like many of the families that we serve, all the problems and gifts that come with living in poverty. Through her involvement with the group, she began to realize, and she actually said this in group one day, and I think the therapist wanted to weep. She said, "I can make a different choice." She has been especially curious about our bilingual, bicultural staff and the speakers that we occasionally invite to talk to the girls about the paths that they've taken and the barriers that they've met with and how they've overcome that. She often asks lots and lots and lots of questions, especially from the women from the community who look like her, about the choices that they've made, about the challenges that they've encountered, some of which are very similar to hers, and some of which are very different. And what we began to realize with Kay and with our other girls, and we didn't start out doing this, we started out with thinking we got to figure something out because these kids aren't coming to school. What we began to realize is through their participation in this process, Kay and the other group members, our other girls, are beginning to imagine a different world of possibilities, that they could have another way of being, that they could have a different life. Her truancy at school has decreased. She now has a good GPA, not yet great because she's still recovering, but we have another year. And the best thing is she is on track to graduate. And if she can graduate from high school, she's going to be the first kid from her family to do so. Uh-huh. She's also now engaging in specific individual treatment for the traumas that she's experienced, and she uses the group to provide motivation for her to continue to do that treatment. She'll come to group, and the other girls will say, "Have you been seeing your therapist?" And she'll say, "Yes, I'm going." She recently successfully left a dangerous relationship and has made really significant changes in her life, which aren't easy for a young person. She actually is also now talking about going to college and becoming a therapist to help other young women like herself. And I get chills because the other part of my career has been devoted to working in higher education with first-generation college students. So when I start hearing our kids talk about this, I get excited. I know that the changes for Kay are going to continue to have a ripple effect for her, her parents, and her younger siblings who are still at home, because she's showing them that there's a different path and there's a different way. And today I've shared the story of one child, but I know that the need for many, many children out there is great. I know that the things that we can do can work beautifully. And for the programs that I supervise, I'm especially proud that they work beautifully because they're tailored to the cultural communities that we serve. In the places where they will have the most access, and those are the schools. And so I, you know, would like to ask you to join me today in imagining all these possibilities for all of the children in our community. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to really share Kay's story today with all of you.
Thank you, Dr. Yang. And also, members, if you recall, you know, at the beginning of the session, I shared out just some broad hopes and expectations that are really about how we process our work here. And one of them was a call to, you know, develop a common understanding of who our students are in Minnesota. And your work, Dr. Yang, and the work of Wilder, I think, is partly about translating for us and others of the multicultural reality of our students and the power and the relevancy for that in terms of helping them get to where we want them to get to. So thank you for your work. I'm going to hold off on questions because I want to but please stay there, because I want to. I think this is Christina Hoke.
Hoke. Yes.
Boy, I was close.
You Christina were so close. It's Hulk. Okay.
So let's hear from your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. Thank you for having me. I feel very strange with the microphone in front of me, and she has 10 tips of how to present in front of you all, and I didn't get them. So forgive me. I work in Eden Prairie Schools. I'm a recovering school psychologist. You probably know a little bit about how we work in the schools. We work predominantly with special education students. I work now as a director of health and related services, so I oversee all of the support staff that Dr. Sander spoke of, and nurses, psychologists, social workers. We've had schooling mental health services in our school since 2007, and that's when I was still working as a school psychologist there. And again, Dr. Sander talked about the redundancies of work. What we're here to talk to you about today is really about the continuum, that tertiary level, going back to that triangle that Sue Aberholden shared with you, is really important. What we've discovered in Eden Prairie, and I know when people think of us, they think that we're a very affluent suburb. But the truth of the matter is that our free and reduced lunch rates have increased. Our students of color have increased to 20%. Our achievement gap between folks of color and our white students is pronounced. And SchoolLink Mental Health Services has provided us a way to get access to services for our students. In this economy, especially in the last 4 years, we've discovered that parents are not accessing support services out in the community for a variety of reasons, Some families are self-employed, so they're underinsured. Their kids are underinsured. Back in the day when 8 to 10 sessions pronounced you as cured, or maybe no longer a damaged student, as we used to think of students as, who had mental illnesses, we now realize that parents were not just taking their kids because they didn't want to lose their job. They just couldn't take the time away. So even out in the suburbs, just being able to go to school, pick up your child, sign them out, because we have a lot of security measures now of getting our kids in and out their doors, and then bringing them somewhere, probably down to Wilder, down to Washburn, wherever the community clinic is, it takes about 3 hours. And for good service to happen for these kids, you know, that's 3 hours a week. Who's going to sustain their own job? I know I wouldn't have a job if I had to take my child 3 hours a week to go and get treatment. So for us, it's been a great way of access and finishing and getting through treatment. What we've discovered in our preliminary data is the more treatment that a student has, the better outcomes. I've created a pamphlet that you guys are seeing, and of course there's a typo on the back, but the one thing I want you guys to see is that our preliminary data, we serviced about 204 kids during the school year 2011-2012, which doesn't sound like a lot when you have 9,200 kids in the district, which is one point I want to make. But preliminary results are showing that when I compare their MCA achievement data to what they had 3 years ago to what they have now, it's gone up, 94% of those kids. That's not something to take lightly. It's real. So I'm going to continue to gather the data so I can continue to share it with those that are willing to listen, like you folks, so I appreciate that. The other part to this is that our attendance rates have improved. I wanted to get suspension rates out to you, but I'll be really honest, people define suspension a little differently from school to school, so I didn't think that would be very accurate. The other thing I wanted to share is, as a school psychologist, I'm now a convert to this work. In the beginning, when it first came to us, and I remember my director of special ed coming to me and saying, here's what we got, and she was really, really excited, and I thought, well, I'm here, why can't I do this work? And she said, no, you're here to do assessment and identification of students with special needs. These are the students that need support. These are the students that need active therapy. And this is how we can provide the wraparound services. It's that dovetailing the medical community with the educational system. And that's important because we've been so fragmented and working in our silos that these kids are slipping through the cracks. So we have 9,200 kids in our school system in Eden Prairie approximately. If the National Institute of Mental Illness and NAMI are correct, we have approximately 20 students between the ages of 9 and 17 in our organization that could, that will develop some sort of mental health challenge. 20%. So 20% of my 9,200 kids is about 1,860. So I need to be prepared to service 1,860 kids in some way, somewhere on that continuum. And the gap, I can fill in the bottom two parts with my psychs, my social workers, my nurses. We're strapped, we're tight, but that's their purpose, is to be in those realms. But SchoolLink Mental Health Services is to be at that top part. And then that way we can all be together. Oftentimes it's just about geography that we can then be able to collaborate. So I thank you today for your time and for your interest in this topic that we all have an extreme passion about.
Thank you. Members, any questions for Ms. Houck or Dr. Yang? Representative Crecia.
Thank you, Chair Mariana. Just a thank you for the presentation, and just a question. I have to ask the outstate question versus the metro question, because where I come from, I absolutely understand where you're coming from. And one of the things, if you could help educate me and clarify, as I look through this and I hear the challenges you have, I also know the commitment that Eden Prairie has put into their sports programs and many of the other things they've done. Do you also get that same amount of commitment for the services you're asking from your local administrators? Because out where I am, in Piers, Little Falls, in that area, we're just trying to get by. And so my question to you is, what kind of support, you know, I mean, I would hope that as you look at that support, you would be coming to us and saying, hey, we're a leader in this area as well, and here's what other schools can be doing. So if you can help me with a little bit of that, that'd be great.
That's Representative Krisha, it's a great question, but I would say most school districts around the state will probably tell you they're trying to get by, too. Mm-hmm. It's just different things that they're trying to get by with. Ms. Howe.
Well, in there, I did briefly put in our little funding structure. We use grant funds to support this work. I often, when I talk about school-based mental health services, it's kind of the best-kept secret in Eden Prairie, to be quite honest. And we're only servicing 3% of our kids with this work. So in my mind, that's not enough. I do have support because they trust that we're using research-based interventions to work with our kids. So we have put in general fund dollars to offset the cost of these services for our providers. Our providers, because they rely on third-party reimbursement and other granting systems and philanthropic efforts to keep this alive, I do grant some of my granting funds that I generate in the district to the providers to help offset costs, especially where the most of the work that they can't bill for is those things called ancillary services, the collaboration time it takes, the care coordination that it takes for our therapist to do. So, and then the other part is we do use general funds.
So to represent Krisha's question, then, it's vitally important to have kind of broad public awareness within the district of this work, and
it's not broad.
Supportive.
It's not broad,
it's
but
not
they're
broad.
Supportive.
Okay, all right. Yes, Representative Krisha.
And just to follow up, Chair Mariana, and no offense, but getting by for us in an indoor facility is five people or five different sports using a gym versus some of the indoor facilities. And I absolutely understand, but my point is, in education, priorities are very hard to rank. And I absolutely, in hearing this in the early childhood, this is an important topic. And my point and my comment, if I could, is that school districts, because we are getting by across the state, some shuffling of services is well received, at least from my vantage point. So, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Krisha. Representative Erickson and Representative Barrett, and then we'll move on to our final two testifiers. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chairman. My question concerns we talk about mental health care workers, counselors, social workers, school nurses, principals, doctors, psychiatrists, psychologists. In my school, you talk about 9,000 students. That doubles the population of my county. My school has classes going through about 35 or 40 students. That's some of the larger ones. That's not a class size. That's a grade size. Okay. We have a tendency to blur a lot of those titles together. We have social workers that have been funded by our local hospital at times just to get two of them in the building. And so when the hospital stopped doing that and the district saved some money by cutting one back, that one person almost quit because the caseload that she was starting to deal with doing K-12 instead of just 7 through 12. And so in outstate Minnesota, we have issues. You know, we're happy to have two social workers, but they are also the counselors, the all of the others. And we would sure love to have additional resources to, you know, we have a psychiatrist or psychologist that comes in from our regional district council up there, comes in once a week, and basically he does assessments. You know, there's not any kind of treatment or anything that goes on there. And, you know, our principals end up doing a lot of that work. So my question is how do you, you know, and you say there's already a shortage of mental health care workers, how in the world are we up in our rural areas going to ever meet those needs?
Wish to tackle that.
Was that
now
rhetorical?
We can also hold the question.
Was that rhetorical? That's a terrible joke. You're right. We do have an extreme shortage, but here's the thing. It's about early intervention, and it's about defining roles. So I've worked in a district that had many of the familiar challenges that you've shared, and that's why we're all here. I think what it comes down to is we have to understand that the educational system isn't able to provide therapy. What we're talking about with SchoolLink Mental Health Services is about access to it. So if you have agencies like Wilder and Washburn, all the ones that were talked about, if they're able to provide, if you can provide them an office space, which is essentially what we do in Eden Prairie, is I provide them office space and a phone. They come, and now they're able to provide treatment. And the result, our school psychologists, our social workers, and our nurses don't feel as taxed in their time and in their work. They can actually focus on what they were hired to do.
So earlier intervention, defining the roles, and the ability that we can to have schools be access points as opposed to attempting to ramp up to be primary care providers. Representative Barrett, and then we'll move on.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Ms. Houck, I guess a question for you would be, if you could tell us what your perception is, if any, of the relationship between this program and special education in your school. In other words, does this promote more kids going into special ed appropriately, or does it promote maybe kids not having to go a special route because their needs have been met or at least understood through the normal educational process?
Ms. Hunt.
Thank you for the question. Actually, this is the question that would get me ramped up, because when we brought in this work in 2007, it was our hypothesis that it would deter some unnecessary referrals to special education. And it has, to a certain degree. When I started in Eden Prairie in 2002, I think our special education population was like 13%. Technically, we've always heard that 10% is a good number to have, as it should reflect the general population of folks with disabilities. So it was high then. And so come 2007, our numbers have gone down, and we're hovering at that 10.5%, 11% in special education. Parallel to this is that during this time, care and treatment centers and residential treatment for kids, the access to that, the amount of that has gone down virtually to none. And intermediate school districts that we contract with, like 287, will take our kids that are very, very high needs. However, they're struggling also, because what happens when the kids get hospitalized for a suicide attempt over the weekend? Where do they go after their 72-hour hold? They come back to school, and they just re-enter the system that was so difficult for them to function in anyways. And so that's why SchoolLink has helped us with that, because it's that other layer of one-on-one specific support, and that's that bridge between the medical world and the educational world. So that was a long way of me saying it's helped. I think it can do better.
Thank you. Members, we're going to move on. I have so many questions I'd love but we just to ask, but we just don't have time. And Dr. Yang, I and perhaps you and I can have a conversation offline. I totally get the argument that you have to have structure, but you also have to have this in the world that we live in, you also have to have this level of relationships that reflects the cultural diversity and relevancy, therefore, that many of these students have. So one of the things I'm curious about is, so I know Wilder's doing that, but what about the rest of the state? Because the whole state is becoming phenomenally, demographically diverse. I suspect many of the same challenges you're seeing here in the Twin Cities we'll see in many corners of our state in terms of access to culturally relevant strategies, therapies, and relationships. So having teased everyone with that, perhaps that's something we can come back to at some point. But thank you for your work. Thank you both. Sheila Davies and Kathy Lombardi. Sheila is with the School Nurses of Minnesota. Kathy Lombardi is with School Social Workers of Minnesota. We have about a little under 20 minutes left, members, but I think we can do this and hopefully get a few questions in at the very end here. So who's going to start here?
I will start first, Mr. Chairman.
Wonderful.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sheila Davies, and I am the school nurse at Champlain Park High School. I am privileged to represent School Nurse Organization of Minnesota at your hearing this morning. It truly is a privilege to talk about mental health. I got this opportunity on rather short notice, and so I too am going to talk about some of my students and some of my experiences. But I want to emphasize that I am very lucky to work in the school in which I work, because we do work collaboratively with counselors, with the school psychologist, with the social worker, who is just new, and we have outside therapists in our building. From a Headway organization, we have 1.5 therapists. Their caseloads are totally full, and there's a waiting list for help for them. I am sometimes the first stop of parents and students. It's sort of that body-mind connection, and I am brought in always if a student is threatening self-harm or has a situation where they are in crisis and may need hospitalization. My tongue-in-cheek statement is, if a student is in crisis and needs to be hospitalized, I'm really hoping that they do it on a Monday or a Tuesday, because there may be adolescent beds available in the Twin Cities. Mm-hmm. But I have had students have to be hospitalized in Brainerd or in Duluth or in Fargo because there are not enough adolescent mental health beds here. I do believe that having the school mental health link available in schools reduces that crisis mode and helps these kids be able to function in an academic setting. The role of a school nurse is to keep a student in the classroom. And again, the student comes with everything they have going on. And I really think, you know, when you're looking at the makeup of schools and whether we have students of color or of ethnic differences, I really think we're becoming much more disparate on economic lines. If a student steals from the cafeteria, is it because their friends put them up to a joke and you know, and they want to do it? Or are they trying to take food home for their mom for the night? More often than not, it's that second choice, that they don't have food at home, and they need help with that. I deal with students whose parents are in a mental health crisis of their own, students whose parents can't get out of bed in the morning, students whose parents can't go to work, and that student then becomes the parent for that family. It really is, it's becoming much more of a challenge. And when I talk about the physical nature, taking care of the physical part of a student's body, as we all know, with healthcare, with the advances, people that you see now in ICUs probably 10 years ago were dead. People that you see on regular hospital floors 10 years ago would have been in an ICU. And people who are treated same-day surgery or short-term stay years ago, 10 years ago, would have been hospitalized. That is the same realm that mental health runs. 10 years ago, a kid who was seen as depressed was probably told to buck up and get over it, and you know, you'll get past it. And in some cases with that dysthymia, that is true, that some kids who are blue for whatever reason can, with you know, encouragement and with some help, positive self-talk, you know, get out of it. But we are seeing an increasing number of students who are clinically depressed or significantly mentally ill who need more than what school staff can offer. So that bringing that therapeutic aspect to school to help support us would be terrific. Anoka Hennepin's been in the news a lot lately. But we have a new mental health specialist that was hired to help kind of coordinate services in our school district. And we were asked as nurses to come up with 3 to 5 suggestions as to what we would like to see changed in our district. And right away, I could write back right away with these, I won't tell you number five because it was said that I need a raise, but that was very selfish. What I said was all staff, but especially support staff, need more training in responding to mental health concerns when a student just shows up in their office or shows up in their classroom. I know for MDE we have to take a mental health class in order to renew our educational license. That class, that requirement is very simplistic. It's very it's very surface, and teachers and other support staff need to know what they're seeing when a student needs help. Nurses need to be involved in for both the physical and the psychological perspective. Again, when students are in crisis and they've threatened self-harm or they've attempted that and they're in the school setting, of course I respond to the physical nature of that, but people bring me in to ask questions, and I think it's because I'm old and I'm not very nice. But if a student has threatened self-harm, I want to know, are you going to or are you not going to? What is your plan? What are you going to do? And then I will make the call to the parent and say that they need to be evaluated. I can't tell you the numbers of students I've sent to be evaluated, and parents have taken them to the emergency room, and they've sat there for 6 hours, had no help, and they pick up and go home. And then again, somebody else mentioned that the student is back in school the next day. I might know that because I see him walking by my door, or sometimes a parent will call. The same thing happens when, and that's my third suggestion, we need better communication with outside resources for when students are getting a service and are planning to return to school. Right now, I don't know of any transition. I have been to many discharge conferences for kids with physical ailments, and there might be 20 people sitting around the table talking about that student's physical needs when they come back to school. When students are released from mental health facilities, again, I might find that out because I see them walking by. There is no continuum or no discharge planning or no communication, and I think that is bothered by both HRPA and HIPAA, and their privacy thing. The other thing is the stigma of mental health, mental illness. I talk to kids or parents that students will get help for strep throat or appendicitis or mononucleosis, but nobody wants to admit that their student has a mental health issue, and that needs to change, and so we need more education along that line. The other thing is schools... We need to know, support staff, everybody needs to know, that schools are educational institutions. They are not locked mental health facilities. We have to address those needs. We have to refer those kids out, or we have to get therapists in that can help us with that. But we need to know, how to handle mental health concerns and how to channel those kids in the right direction. I am lucky that I work at Champlain Park. We have a group that meets every other week. It's called SACAMO, Social Emotional, and it is support staff. It's the psychologists, the social workers, the student learning advocates, the prevention advisor, and counselors. And we talk about not only, in general, the kids that we serve, but we talk about care for the caregiver, because as it becomes more and more acute and more serious and more severe, we all need help with that.
Ms. Thies, I'm going to move you along because
okay,
I want to make sure
sorry.
Your colleague can
okay,
get in
that's right.
As well.
Well, simply, I think we just need rocking chairs and resiliency class. We need people to greet kids in the morning to let them know that they're acknowledged. And that, I spent half my day yesterday with two students that just wanted somebody to tell them that it was important that they were at school. I thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Davies. Ms. Lombardi.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Kathy Lombardi, and I work as a school social worker. I've been working as a social worker in St. Paul School for about 17 years. For the past 10 years, I've had the privilege of serving as the lead school social worker for the district. I also have many years of experience working at as a mental health professional in a crisis program in a community mental health clinic. Today, I appreciate the opportunity to share with you some of my experience with our school-linked mental health grants, and also share with you the variety of roles that school social workers fill in meeting the needs of students that present with some mental health concerns. First of all, I don't want to be too repetitive, but I just have to briefly say that the organization I'm representing, MISWA, really agrees with the other people that testified on the idea that we need to have a continuum of mental health supports in schools. And one really important part of that continuum is our school-linked mental health program that exists in our state. I've worked in St. Paul schools to help build our school-linked program and have had the privilege of working with Wilder, who's our fiscal agent for that grant and partners with us as part of that grant in some of our schools. But in St. Paul, we have a number of very successful school mental health community partnerships with Wilder. So these programs are very valuable in many of our schools. And I just want to make sure that we understand that our school support teams, those are school social workers, school counselors, nurses, psychologists, play a very important part in contributing to those school-linked partnerships and making sure they're successful. As mentioned earlier, we're often the ones that are explaining the services to families, seeking releases of information so that families give us their permission to share with our providers reasons for referrals. In St. Paul, kind of like Dr. Sanders explained, we're following a very similar process, that there's a point person in the school that makes those referrals to the community agency and is sort of someone that tries to understand both roles, the school role as well as that of the community provider. So I'm very happy to see that this is possible to be continued and is included in the governor's budget, because we want to continue and expand this work in St. Paul. It's really also important to know that, you know, collaborating with community providers is a foundational principle of school social work practice. I mean, we as school social workers view ourselves as the school link between home, school, and community and the families. So we want to partner with our community agencies. But it's also important to recognize that school social work services themselves do have a place on this continuum of mental health services that are in schools. We provide a variety of different services based on the kind of school we work at or the funding for our position. So, you know, I know a lot about the role in St. Paul schools. From sitting on the board of the Minnesota School Social Work Association, I have colleagues from all around the state, and so the role does vary. I have a colleague that works in way northern Minnesota and, you know, travels to support, you know, a district, and she might travel 30, 40 miles between different schools in one day. Very different than what I do here, but we are providing services to students that belong on the continuum. We will work with both special education and general education students that present with mental health problems that range from difficulty, you know, learning about a new school, adjusting to a new school, bullying prevention, all the way up to students that might present with significant psychiatric or developmental disorders. I want to talk a little bit about how some of our social workers provide mental health services that might be included on a student's individual education plan. And there was a question earlier about how school-linked mental health services might fit in with special education. And we also in St. Paul have hypothesized that if we get early intervention services available to families and accessible to families, it may offset some of our referrals for special education due to social, emotional, or behavioral concerns. However, there are students that have significant special education needs and have been identified as students with a disability, and some of them have mental health services on their IEP, their individual education plan. And it's important to realize that schools are mandated to seek reimbursement for these mental health services on the IEP, whether they're provided by a community agency or a school employee. And in order to assist school districts in being able to maximize this third-party reimbursement for the mental health services on an IEP, you know, we would like to work with you to streamline a current system that, you know, includes many barriers to accessing the funds for this. And I want to make sure that we understand that these funds for medical assistance for IEP services, when school districts receive those, it's only the federal funds, not the Minnesota MA covered services. And these are often not the services that are provided by school linked. One thing I kind of want to say is I totally, you know, as a school employee, I'm very familiar with this PBIS model. And I would like to say that there's almost a fourth tier of students with significant mental health concerns and special education needs that are in maybe special schools or self-contained settings. And I find that this is not the group, at least in my experience, that are receiving services from the School Linked grant. It's another part of the continuum, and I think we really need to help maximize the reimbursement that schools need in order to provide these mandated services for their students with disabilities. And just a couple other points I thought. I know I'm stressed for time, but I just want to point out that school social workers, many of us are licensed at the LICSW level, which does qualify us as a mental health professional with the credentials to diagnose and treat mental illness. We are not all LICSWs. Other social workers might be practitioners working under supervision. But I want to make it clear that just because you're a school social worker doesn't mean that you are under any different data privacy or we're governed by the same board of social work. So working in a school, I am required to have the same education, experience, clinical supervision, training that a provider would have working out in the community. And therefore, school social workers are oftentimes the member of the student support team that really understands mental health issues and works with the team, the family, and community providers to start to help schools address how a student's mental health needs might be impacting their education. And, you know, we're glad to have partners in doing this work because school social workers really believe and we're trying to make a difference in addressing a student's mental health needs and how critical of a role that plays in their academic achievement. So just in summary, I'd like to say that we need to really support this continuum of services and understand that, you know, schools are trying to provide a free, appropriate public education for all our students. And for some of those students, that includes mental health services. And sometimes when families are not able, for whatever reason, to engage with a community mental health provider or stay engaged over a period of time with a provider, you know, the school support staff are really there to try to fill in those gaps and continue to work with our students and families, because it's really about making sure that those kids get what they need to be successful in school.
Thank you, Ms. Lombardi. And a couple of themes, there's several themes from both of you. We're not going to do justice for all of them, but a couple of things that sort of perked my ears were this whole issue of streamlining the reimbursement process is perhaps a weak link in our ability to have a really holistic system here. I take it that that involves the Minnesota Department of Education, and so we will probably should be having some conversations with them. Similarly, Ms. Davies, on the more training of the five, you only gave us four, but of the five that you shared, the more training aspect probably also involves deeper conversations with the Department of Education. Members, and thank you both for your testimony. Thank you for the work that you do. Vitally important, and I really appreciate all the testifiers here who really reinforced, I think, consistently this notion that this isn't just about one sector. This is about really powerful links that obviously, you know, are powerfully present, I think, throughout the entire state, but at least the structure and the components of that exist in our state. And I think as stewards of the state's resources and policy frame, it's important for us to bear in mind the importance of a highly collaborative system that's very smartly, I think, identified ways in which to efficiently meet the needs of our students, even though we know we're not meeting all of those. So thank you all for your testimony today, members. I apologize to every of you who have questions, but I suspect we'll be coming back to these issues in the weeks to come. And so, members, we'll stand adjourned.